the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. That was Sarita, my wife, singing Sunny with the legendary Joe Pass Trio. And, of course, that was Frank Sinatra introducing me in the late 70s when he hosted The Tonight Show one evening. It's November 30th, 5 p.m. Pacific time. This is John Barber's World. You all saw Black Friday. Well, folks, this is Meaningful Monday, and you'll know why in just a minute. Speaking of Black Friday, over the years, like you, I've seen pictures of African families where every day, for a lack of food, was indeed a black day. And I have seen them when planes drop bags of rice and bread to these skeletal creatures. And not once did they exhibit the cruel piranha feeding frenzy over getting something to eat free, as did millions of my fellow Americans clawing at each other in Walmart or Target to buy a $150 television set. And when they get home, there's nothing to watch. Believe me, folks, in a year, all sports will be pay-per-view. And just remember this, the beauty you see is never, ever as rewarding as the beauty you can create. You know, how monumentally deranged are literally thousands of my other fellow Americans. They storm abortion centers and Planned Parenthood centers, killing occupants to save an unborn fetus. Yet they never storm an Army recruiting center or Congress to kill the lying politicians who send these fully grown humans into fake wars where they are then killed. God must have taken some time off and turned the assignment for creating these folks over at one of his governmental agencies. You know, there are probably over a million Americans like me who do not fully view this past Thanksgiving, or even this upcoming Christmas, as such a happy family day. I mean, how can you when you grow up or you're without a family? But what I used to give thanks for when I was living in this country years ago, I gave thanks for the fact that it had a constitution, it had a democracy, it avoided foreign entanglements, rewarded and did not punish whistleblowers, had convictions of war profiteers. It had a labor movement. It had dissenting free speech. It had music in schools. And it didn't murder men like John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. Now I'm just thankful I have a good memory. H.L. Mencken, one of America's great writers and wits, said in the early 30s, no one in the country ever went broke, underestimating the intelligence of the American people. Well, history has not only proven Mencken right, but so has Donald Trump, who seems to be proving we've gotten dumber. Almost every speech Trump gives, where he displays this brown shirt mentality of Nazi Germany, hoping a heckler gets beaten more, or his desire to have Muslims cataloged or branded like cattle or German Jews, or lies about Muslims dancing in New Jersey after 9/11, It's unbelievable, but after one of these tirades, like a sick comic, he picks up more followers. Too bad we can't sort of take one of the planks from his platform and exile or deport stupid people. There would be a lot of open space in deserted cities in the United States of America. Now, to me, folks, America's had barely a half a dozen great writers whose lives were as big as their work, beginning with Mark Twain, Sinclair Lewis, Ben Hecht, H.L. Mencken, Gore Vidal, Gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson, and even Chicago columnist Mike Royko. And tonight's guest, by far the most prolific and varied of them all, the last of the greats who has always put his feet and his fists where his mouth is. Great words, often angry words, flow out of him as unstoppably as water over Niagara Falls. Writing is to this man what oxygen is to the rest of us. It keeps him alive. And us who love to read him, everything he writes for or has written for is always considered the best in its genre. Star Trek, Twilight Zone, Alfred Hitchcock's, all the experts say it's the best, as does he.
He's absolutely right. I am humbled by their credit and by their approbation and by your talking to me, John.
Okay, hang on a second, Harlan. He is the author of 75 books, 1,700 short stories and articles in 40 languages with that many rewards. So when I got my very first TV show in Los Angeles in the late 60s, he was a second guest I called to book, following my friend Red Fox, who no one would put on the air at the time. But at this time, my friend and my guest was writing the best critiques about television in the country in a column in the Free Press called The Glass Seat, still wonderfully readable. And one of the people he attacked was me. Now, who wouldn't want to talk to someone this bright? Ladies and gentlemen, the incomparable, the mouth that roared truth constantly, Harlan Ellison. Harlan, it's so wonderful that you're here and so glad to talk to you again.
Well, John, it's finally good that you stopped the rant and you let me get a word in edgewise.
Well, it's the first time that I've ever been able to do that. Harlan, one of the very, very first photographs I ever saw you was as a young kid. You were walking down the street, I believe, with your mother. And I believe your mother's name was Sarita, wasn't it?
My mother's name was Sarita.
Yeah, well, my wife's name is Sarita. So anyway, you're standing to the right of her, and you're looking over to your left at a camera, and you're sticking your tongue out. It's like you started at an extremely early age and are still doing it in 2015. Bless your talented heart.
Well, it's remarkable that you would remember that, John. That goes back a long way.
Well, Harlan, you know, I have a remarkable memory for talents that I admire and love. You know, I can quote your stuff forever. But tell me, from the beginning, tell us just a little bit about your family, if you had siblings, parents, and what you did as a youngster, and when you decided or knew that you were meant to be a writer.
Well, I knew right away. It would be, I would either be a writer or an industrialist of some kind. But I knew right away I would be a writer for the first time I started writing. And I began writing and book after book after book after book. And after 215 books, he got quite a storage locker of books. And everybody can go to harlanellisonbooks.com. And they can pull up as many books as they want.
Well, I must tell you, there is nobody as monumentally prolific as you are, and everything that comes out of you is absolutely and wonderfully meaningful. But when you went to school, Do you remember turning in stories in your English classes, and how were they graded, and how were your teachers toward you?
Well,
and
yes,
what were your inspirations?
Until I went to college. In college, I took an English writing class, and I would turn in a story a day. And the instructor was a stodgy old man, and he said, "You'll never be a writer." And I punched him out, and they threw me out of Ohio State University. So I said, "Screw it," and I went off, and I became a writer. The first year I sold 12 stories, and the second year I sold 120 stories. And it's gone on ever since then.
And when you sold these stories, did you send him copies of the stories that you wrote?
Yes. I always send him copies so that he would always steal. After a while, they didn't stop coming back, so I knew he was getting them.
Do you remember the very first story you got published and how much you got for it?
I sure do. The first story I published was called Trojan Hearse. And I got paid something like $115 for it.
$115 in those days was quite a bit. How old were you?
Oh, I was about 18.
Oh, how wonderful. Now, when you became a writer and started, and you began to have these stories appear in all these various magazines, were you doing that on your own? Did you solicit to get yourself an agent or a manager, or did somebody come looking for you?
No, agents came looking for me, and they came to me, and I've been with the same agent for 30 years.
Oh, how wonderful. What's his or her name?
His name is Richard Curtis.
Oh, my God. How
Richard
wonderful.
Curtis and I have been buddies for 30 years.
Oh, how wonderful. It's so great.
It takes a lot of courage to be my friend for a lot of years.
Well,
I'm a hard nut to chew, old kid.
Well, your agent lasted a lot longer than some of your wives.
Well, I've only had four wives.
Okay, now you get yourself this terrific agent. What then made you move to Hollywood?
I had been married to my third wife for about a year. And she was a wonderful woman, but I finally came to the realization that I liked her a lot, but I did not love her. And I knew I could not live in a lie like that. So she said, "At least if you're going to divorce me, take me to California." I said, "Okay." And I did. And she came out here, and I put her in an apartment in
Santa Monica?
Pretty close to Santa Monica. Very expensive section. I always took care of Billy. That was my third. I've been with my fourth wife, Susan, for 30 years.
Terrific. Well, thank goodness you have Susan, because she also helped us get in touch with you so that you do the show. So what was your first assignment, your first job that you got in Hollywood?
My first job was writing some good-for-nothing article about somebody or other. I was working as an editor at Rogue magazine. And they said, "Here, do this article," and I did it. And it was published, and next thing I knew, I was the associate editor of the magazine.
And then you got into movies and television as a result of writing for Rogue magazine, editing Rogue?
No, I got into movies because one of my books was bought by Otto Preminger. And he wanted to make a movie of it. And they brought me out here. And they set me up, and I put Billy up in an apartment of her own, and I went about my business writing. And then we got divorced, and I went on with my life, and she went on with hers. She had another husband. I met my wife, Susan, 20 years after that, and we've been together 30 years.
That's wonderful. The book that was bought by Auto Premature, what was that book? And for you, what were your inspirations, the writers that you liked to read, the writers that you inspired you to do the work that you do? And I must say, in many, many instances, Harlan, you probably topped all of your inspirations.
Well, the writer who inspired me the most was Mark Twain. And thereafter, it was writers like, Victor Hugo and
the storytellers.
The
storytellers were the ones that you liked.
The storytellers were the ones I liked, and it is they whom I've tried to emulate.
Because you do write unbelievable stories. I mean, my son's favorite story, I believe, from Star Trek was The City on the Edge of the World.
City on the Edge of Forever.
Yeah, On the Edge of Forever. Stories.
We just did that as a graphic novel and four illustrated volumes.
It
sold a million copies. It was number one on the New York Times bestseller list.
Okay, now you have a reputation, of course. They've used the word curmudgeon, but you are much more than that. I mean, you were sort of the original angry young man, and they always used to say, if you're in Hollywood, do not get angry at these folks, and do not fight with these folks. But in the great DVD, which is the Dreams with Shark Teeth, there you are with Robin Williams telling how you punched people out.
John, I have had more fist fights with more producers than you have ever met with.
Well, how
there
could...
are people who own their entire studios who are not allowed to appear.
Well, how come... I guess I could answer my own question and say, well, how come you're still working? It's because your work is so good they can't turn you down.
Right.
But also...
whenever it comes to the time at the point where everybody else has been turned down, somebody will at that point say, why don't we try Harlan Ellison? Then they beat him up. And when they're done beating him up, then they hire me.
Who was the person with whom you enjoyed working the most in either films and television? And then who were some of the worst that you couldn't abide being with?
Well, one of the best was Norman Lear. And the worst were some of the ones that you would think of. But most of the ones who were the worst, I kicked them in the ass, and I cost them money. I never got even with people. I just waited them out. I waited them out until they needed a favor, and then I just didn't do it.
Yeah, but you more than waited them out. I know, because I remember the lawsuit. Tell us a little bit about the lawsuit over the Terminator, how it came about, and how people, maybe even your friend, your agent, told you, hey, listen, Harlan, don't be suing Paramount or ABC over stuff like
City
this.
Hall.
You'll never
and
work
I
again.
I said, yeah, I can't fight City Hall. And I sued Paramount, and I sued the people who made the Terminator.
And what did you sue them over? What was
I
the story?
Rights to the story, which they had pilfered.
From
and
what?
It was property rights. And I won. And I won $4.5 million.
Is it true that you took out a billboard on Sunset Boulevard that said, I beat the bastards?
Yeah, I said, if you stick your hand in my pocket, I'll bite it off.
You know, nobody could, but you could get away with that sort of thing.
And now, I never forgive, but I never forget either.
Okay, for you, what is, do you feel, is the most rewarding writing that you have ever done, or a few of the pieces that you are proudest of?
Well, there's a book that's just out now. It's the latest of my books. It's the ninth iteration, the ninth time this book has been published, and I've gussied it up and extended it. It's called Ellison Wonderland.
Oh, what a great title.
Well, it's the only time I've ever allowed myself to use a joke like that. And it was published in England and done over here, and has come out in two different editions. And they're beautiful. They're both hardbound, slipcased together. One is
And can these be bought in Barnes & Nobles, or would they have to go to your
site? Yeah, you can go on to Barnes & Noble, you can go to Amazon, you can go anywhere. Go to HarlanEllisonBooks.com, and you'll see all of my books listed up there. They're all there, and you can buy as few or as many as you wish. I can make you gag with how many books you can buy.
Wow. That's the next one on my list. What a great, great title. Ellison in Wonderland. My goodness gracious, that is so imaginative. Harlan, before you became somebody who could earn a living as a writer or suing studios, what kind of jobs did you do to support yourself?
Oh, my God, John, I did everything. I was a floor walker. I was a short order cook. I was I scraped dead cats off floors. I did every job untutored could do. I was incredibly talented, but untrained in anything. So whatever job they said, can you be a counter cook? I'd say, yes, I can be a counter cook. Have you ever flipped flies? Flip flies.
I said that there's that wonderful exchange that you have between yourself and Robin Williams in Dreams with Sharp Teeth. And it really kind of saddened me a lot, because I met Robin and I was involved with the revival of the Laugh-In specials, and that was the first time America got to see Robin Williams on national television, and he was just wonderful.
Yeah, Robin was one of a kind. I were his closest brothers.
Yeah, well, when you said to him, I want to have your kid, and you hugged him, and he said, I got three, I'll send one over. You two guys were never at a loss for words, but tell the story about driving that dynamite truck.
Well, I had been hired to work on a construction crew, and they asked me if I could drive a truck, and I said, sure, I could. I could no more drive a truck than the man in the moon. But I said, yeah, sure, I can do it. Well, it turned out I was driving it in Shelby, North Carolina, up and down cross-cutting roads, and here I was going up a road with a truckload of dynamite. And another truck was coming down at me. And I had to pull off the road into a culvert so I wouldn't get crushed.
Oh, he was so funny when he turned to you and he said in that southern accent, let's have our little Jew drive over this bumpy road with a truck full of dynamite. Okay, now, you've passed the stage where you're doing these odd, weird jobs. How old were you when you had to stop earning a living like this and could earn a living only as a writer? Do you remember how old you were?
14.
You're kidding.
I'm not kidding.
You mean you didn't have to work any of these weird jobs after we were 14?
When I was 14, I was starting to sell for the first time. And I started to sell immediately. And when I saw that I could make, for 1,500 words, I could make $150, that was a lot of money in those days. And if I did two nights' work, $2,500, 2,500 words, penny a word. And that was more than enough to keep me. I was living on $30 a week back in those days. That was in New York. I had a $10 a week room, and I had my typewriter, and I worked night and day. I worked like a goddamn dog, John.
And you still type with just your index finger and your left and right hand?
That's right.
Oh, my goodness gracious. That's just startling. Well, you're absorbed with this passion to write. Then what was it about you, and when did you think you would get involved with Martin Luther King's March on Selma? When did these things begin to occur to you?
When did who seek truth to me?
Yeah, no. Obviously your entire body wants to write. Your mind wants to write. Okay, and yet you still had that within you that saw what was going on in the society in which you lived, which in the 60s was the civil rights movement.
I can't stop writing. I go to sleep at night with ideas that are still half-formed in my head. I get up in the morning and I start writing, and I sit down and I don't stop until I'm done writing a story.
And did you do the same when you went to the March on Selma? Were you still writing in your head? Were you recording...
Yeah.
All these experiences?
I wrote everything. I wrote everything down. I put everything on paper. Eventually, one day, it turned into a story.
Did you ever fear for your life at the time you were in Selma?
Did I fear for my life? Every moment. When they turned the dogs loose on us... And when we went marching down the street, they had the Alabama National Guard standing with their rifles turned in toward us. Not turned out to protect us, but turned in toward us. We knew very well who the bad guys were.
When you look at your country today, and you look at the candidates... that we have, I mean, 99% elect the president, but it looks like the 1% select the president. What are your thoughts about your country today?
I think we're in a very sad state where the only two choices we have are an imbecile like Trump and a woman like Hillary Clinton, whom I don't trust. I think of the two, she's probably the better of the two, but I don't know that she'll do any better than her husband. So, when the time comes to vote, I will vote because I'm a voter, and I'm not committed one way or the other, but I'm not happy with either choice.
You have any thoughts about Bernie Sanders?
No, not at the moment. I keep looking around for somebody to step out of the crowd. And everyone who steps out of the crowd seems even dumber than the one before them.
They're the ones who get attention. Did you ever have children, Harlan?
Nope, never had any children.
Was that a deliberate choice?
Yeah, I knew I'd make a great uncle, great crazy uncle. But I'd make a terrible father. I was too busy being Harlan Ellison to be a really helpful father.
Are you now a great uncle, a terrific uncle?
Oh, I'm a great uncle to hundreds of children.
Really?
They call me Uncle Harlan.
To whom?
Just a lot of kids. I know a lot of kids.
Does,
I don't fondle
does
them. I don't put them on my knee. I let them
Does Susan have nephews and nieces who call you Uncle Harlan?
No, she's just got one sister. And apart from that, we're the two of us alone. She didn't want any kids, and I didn't want any kids. And we're two happy little people.
Oh, my gosh almighty. There is somebody who... We didn't never announce the phone number here because I just wanted to talk to you alone. But evidently some people are trying to get through to talk to you. So, Don or Doug, could you put the fellow on line two through to Harlan since he went to so much trouble?
Who is this?
Certainly. We have a Gary from New Mexico on line two. Welcome.
Who wants to talk to me?
Gary.
Gary from New Mexico on line two. Thank you so much for calling. And your words to Harlan, your question to Harlan.
As an editor, I do have a question, and I look at Halderman and the authors that you selected for the anthology.
Yeah.
And how did you work through that? Because there's so many, Anne McCarthy, all this, and I know I'm butchering.
An editor is a very tough job. It means being a logician. It means being an editor. It means knowing how to write yourself and not being afraid to take on the very best and tell them that they must do their very best and when they're wrong to help them correct it. And that's what I always did.
And I love your I love you as an editor.
It means not being
I've read. Thank you.
You're welcome, kiddo.
Gary, thank you so much for your call. Harlan, do you think, you express forebodings about the country. How about the state of the arts and especially television and films? It seems to me that Americans make movies about things and Europeans try to make movies about
people.
Well,
television these days, I haven't seen anything on television. With the exception of one series in the last 10 years that I think is worth even looking at.
Which one's that?
It's the one with, why can't I remember the name of it? The two detectives.
Oh, I know. Isn't it called The Detectives?
No.
McConaughey, isn't he the guy that...
No. It was.
Is it a cable show or a network
show? They're bringing it back, and I won't watch the second year because I know they're just going to restage it and regurgitate it. And it was called... Somebody will call it and tell you.
Was it cable or was it network television?
It was cable. And it was incredibly good. It was the first time anybody had done the... they took the book,
Damn it. I'm thinking of a show that I watched that had McConaughey, the actor from Texas.
Yeah, it was McConaughey, and
yes. Whose father was put in prison because he had murdered a judge, and his son became this excellent actor.
Jack McConaughey Woody.
Two guys with senior moments.
Woody
Harrelson.
Woody Harrelson,
yes.
Jason McConaughey.
The first year was wonderful.
It was an incredible series. And then they wanted to reboot it, and I said, nope, they already chewed that cud. I don't want to hear it again.
Well, you're absolutely right, because when they rebooted it this year, and I rushed to look at it because it was so well done, and McConaughey and Harrelson were no longer in it, there was, it was, oh God, that Irish actor was in yeah, the second year.
They recast it and they restaged it, but it was the old idea redone, just kicked over.
Exactly.
And turned on its flop side.
Well, Harlan, listen, I want to thank you so much for being here, and please thank Susan for helping us get you on the air tonight.
My pleasure to talk to you again after all this time.
Oh, my God, it's wonderful. And I will send the 1986 clip to you, even though you have libraries full of your own interviews and stuff, because it was an absolutely delightful, delightful show. And where can people go to get... it is Dreams Have Sharp Teeth, which I
Dreams
got on
Dreams Have Sharp Teeth.
Right.
Is available on Amazon, and it's available on Twitter and Facebook and all those places. But if you go to Facebook and put up HarlanEllisonBooks.com, you go straight to the site with all my books available.
And they can also get their Ellison in Wonderland?
Ellison Wonderland.
Well, when my son saw you years ago in Palo Alto, you gave him an autographed copy of your book, which he treasures to this day. So I'm going to get a half a dozen copies of that book, and somehow I'm going to get a hold of Susan and send them to you. And I want you to autograph them and send them back, and I'll prepay the postage back. And I hope you have a wonderful holiday. And
have a good night yourself, my John.
Listen, I know you've had a little medical problem recently, but the mind is still there, and those two index fingers are still typing.
Yep.
And thank you again so much for being on the show and for being Harlan Ellison now and forever. Thank you so much for
my
being
pleasure,
here.
My pleasure, John.
Okay, bye-bye. Folks, cool. We'll be right back after this brief break with the best informed journalist I know, Joe Satilli. Be right back.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
This is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Welcome back. This is John Barber and John Barber's World. And once again, I want to thank George Knapp for that wonderful unsolicited review of The Last Word on the Assassination, which continues surprisingly to sell every day on Amazon. You can go up there and you can see over 70 other unsolicited reviews. And while you're up there, there's a little book up there, John Barber's first Facebook book, Volume 1, Uncensored. It's sort of chicken soup for the funny bone. You can open it any place and have a terrific laugh. And also, I would suggest you go to johnbarbersworld.com, click on the YouTube icon, and watch Lenosonic's interview with me that he did on July 4th this year and just put up on November 22nd. It's called John Barber's Last Word on the Garrison Tapes. And I must tell you, even if you're not interested in the assassination of John F. Kennedy, but you are interested in America and the medium and a great story, I hate to tell you this, told really well, especially by Len, get it. Go take a look at it. John Barber's Last Word on the Garrison Tapes. Now, to my only, the only person I ever thought I would want as a regular on my show out of San Francisco, the best informed, the most objective journalist that I know, who is now not only a regular on my show, now he's a regular on Chuck Acelli's show someplace else. He's got his own show on Fridays that he co-hosts, and pretty soon he's going to have a network television show on cable somewhere because he's so good at what he does. Joe Satilli from News Vandal. Joe, welcome back to the show.
How well, I don't know how I'll ever get on the air with the incredible show that Trump is producing for the American people called the 2016 election. You know, it is an amazing display, John. You know, yesterday. We just have to get into the election because I guess we have to talk about it. But,
yes.
You know, I did watch Meet the Press. I do this, folks, for you. I watch Meet the Press. I watch This Week. I watch Face the Nation. I use my DVR. I watch them all. I even get up and I watch Fareed Zakaria in the morning, who can be insufferable and informing intermittently. But to watch Chuck Todd say to Donald Trump, the thousands of Muslim men that you saw did not exist. Where did you see it? If you did see it, where is it? Do you have any evidence? We've looked for it. We can't find it. Everybody says it didn't happen. He says, Chuck, I saw it. I saw it on television. It's true. It's really the most amazing moment of my lifetime in observing politics. My first memory as a child was watching the Watergate hearings on television. I am a child of television. I started watching television when I was three. I've never stopped. I remember the helicopters leaving Vietnam during the evacuation. I remember the revolution that led to the hostage crisis. I remember when Nightline began, when Nightline first started in response, Ted Koppel, in response to the hostage crisis, day one of the hostage crisis, day 200. This is the most amazing moment in American political history of my lifetime, to watch Donald Trump quadruple down on this lie about thousands of Muslims celebrating in New Jersey. John, what do you make of this?
Well, it is astonishing to me. I mean, Goebbels in the 30s was telling Hitler, if you keep on lying, the more you lie and the bigger the lie becomes, the more they have to believe it, because they can't believe a lie that big isn't real. And I am astonished that not only does no one really question him firmly about that, but it was dancing Israelis who were arrested. It wasn't dancing Muslims on that panel truck who were arrested.
And folks, if you think this is some kind of conspiracy theory, right now I am looking at a story from the period right after September 11th on ABC News titled, Were Israelis Detained on September 11th? Spies, asking, were they spies, not were they detained? Yes. Maria, who asked us not to use her last name, had a view of the World Trade Center from her New Jersey apartment building. She remembers a neighbor calling her shortly after the first plane hit the towers. She also says she saw three young men kneeling on the roof of a white van in a parking lot of an apartment building. They seemed to be taking a movie. These were young Israeli men. They were held for about 71 days. They were released under an agreement between the United States and the Israeli government. We still have no idea who they are. And this is the interesting thing. There were these sort of spontaneous, sporadic outpourings in the West. It was either in the West Bank or Gaza that made the airwaves after 9/11. But nothing like that happened as terms of what Trump is describing. But as you point out, John, here it is. I'm looking at the story. It's right here. Could he have conflated the two? But that wasn't on television. That's the thing. This was not on television.
Well, nothing seems to be on television anymore.
Well, but this is what I love about it is it was on TV, Chuck. Chuck, it was on TV. I saw it on TV. It happened. Whatever happens on TV, it's got to be true. That in and of itself, I think, is hilarious.
Well, you know, it sort of reminds me of my comment I made earlier at the top of the show about the fact that these people were fighting like piranha over buying a $150 television set. And when they get it home, there's nothing to watch. It was like one of Dick Gregory's great lines out of the 1960s, and he said he sat in at a Woolworth counter until they were finally integrated. He got the menu, and there was nothing he wanted.
So, well, it's the great Catskills joke about two elderly Jewish women complaining about the food, and they're saying, oh, the food is terrible, it's so terrible, and the other woman says, yeah, in such small portions. you know,
okay, I didn't, because of everything that I had to do, and the fact that once again somebody managed to get my credit card info, and for like the third time in a few months I've had to change a credit card. I just got back from LA, where I had a great weekend with my son. My wife and I saw a fabulous hockey game against the Chicago Blackhawks. The Kings were down 2-0. The night before, the Ducks had a 2-0 lead with a minute and a half to go against Chicago and lost the game. The poor lame Ducks. Anyway, it was 2-0 at the beginning of the third, and I turned to my son and I said, the Kings are going to do to Chicago what they just did to the Ducks. They tied them, and then they beat them in overtime. Great game. Anyway, so I'm recovering from that, and I only got a chance to read a couple of the articles from your news, Vanderbilt. The one I was anxious to read was the one about that you headlined Naomi Klein. So tell me what that article is about.
Well, today is the beginning of the Paris UN Climate Conference. It's called COP21. And, you know, I had a number of things there on the rundown. I actually had a couple climate skeptic pieces, orthodoxy pieces. Naomi Klein is in sort of the climate orthodoxy, and which I used to be. Full disclosure, I used to be a bit of a climate skeptic at the turn of the century.
When you say climate skeptic or climate orthodoxy, exactly what do you mean? Because I think I read somewhere that Putin said all this nonsense about warming climate is nonsense. Is that true or not true?
Well, today he was at the conference saying that this is one of the great challenges that mankind faces. So, you know, I'm not sure about previous reports. But you have deniers, you have skeptics, and you have the orthodoxy. And the orthodoxy is, look, the facts are that we're talking 98.9% of all scientists who work in the field of climate and related fields have believed the evidence is there. This is anthropogenic, meaning human created. Anthropogenic climate change is real, that if the globe does not stop pouring carbon dioxide in particular, but there are other gases too, like methane, that increase the temperature of the planet. If they can't stop it by going up 2 degrees, it's going to be catastrophic. This is what Naomi Klein is writing about, the fallout of that, which is as you get more unpredictable climate patterns, you get more severe droughts, more severe flooding, you get loss of coastal cities, you're going to have climate migrations, you're going to have scarcity, you're going to have people competing over scarcity. You know, John, those folks competing over $150 cheap televisions. And you know, the dirty little secret of those televisions and those toaster ovens that they sell is that those are loss leaders that are designed in the factory to be cheap knockoffs of the actual TVs that they like to produce, but they make them cheap as sort of like cheese to put into the rat trap so that everybody will run in and get snapped. And then, you know, they've got them to buy other things. But, If you see people fighting over televisions, wait till they have to fight over potable water, right? And this is what Naomi Klein is talking about. And she is she's part of the climate orthodoxy. I think the orthodoxy has changed or has been established. Now it's pretty much across the board. People believe that climate change is real, it's happening, it's anthropogenic, and it's going to have a massive impact on human populations. It's already having a massive impact on Arctic animal and fish populations and bird populations as well, and monarch butterflies. I mean, we're finding a lot of different impacts in the animal kingdom. Climate skeptics are people who say, okay, it's warming, but do we really know that it's anthropogenic? Because there is evidence that solar flares and sunspots and certain cosmic radiation and other things and just the general movement of climate over time, geological time on the planet, can cause extreme variations. We're just about, what, 400 to 500 years out from something called the mini ice age. There was a mini ice age that happened. So
That's true.
We really just warming out of the mini ice age, or is this anthropogenic? Then you have climate skeptics who say, no, this is all bunk. Many of them happen to be evangelicals who say human beings are taking liberties with God's planet because there's no way human beings could do something that God wouldn't want, like create climate change. But I have to tell you this right now. I have two things here that I think are really, really fascinating. This is a book. I collect old magazines and I collect old TV guides. This is a book called Analog. Analog was a science fiction, science fact combo book that I believe may have been started by Isaac Asimov and was edited for years by the great John Campbell, somebody who I'm sure knew Harlan Ellison. And I believe Harlan Ellison wrote for Analog over the course of the years. And it was science fact and science fiction. So they had science fiction pieces and science fact pieces. This is from January of 1980. And here is the title: Carbon Dioxide and Climate, The Burning Question. Are you sure you know what CO2 buildup in the atmosphere will do? Asks John Gribben. And I've read this piece about, about 8 months ago. And it basically predicts everything that is happening right now. This is from 1980. And then I go back to this. I have a TV guide here from 1981. And if you could believe this, Walter Cronkite's Universe, this is 8 o'clock on a Tuesday night, an examination of how the burning of fossil fuels may affect atmospheric temperatures, melting Arctic ice, and raising global temperatures. That's 1981. So if this
I remember that series well. The thing that is disturbing to me, though, in reading what you would classify as a skeptic's, really, that we are cooling and we're not heating, is that they have all these letters behind them indicating that they have PhDs or masters or whatever it is. And the thing that strikes me is, do I believe that this man believes what he is saying, or is he a hireling paid to tell us this? So it is almost impossible to find something that you can believe.
Well, and this is the problem, is we now know that Exxon, I have these two things, one from 1980 and one from 1981. Exxon had an in-house scientist working on the climate issue in the late 70s. And at the turn of the 70s to the 80s, he was yelling at the top of his lungs, basically inside Exxon, saying climate change is real. If we don't do something, it is going to be catastrophic. And they buried all of his work. This is a scientist internal to Exxon. So obviously there is self-interest at play, right? Because it's basically like saying, yeah, if, you know, 4 out of 5 doctors may say that Terry 10 100s are great in the 50s, but now we know that Terry 10 100s, if you smoke them, gives you cancer. And, you know, right now you have in Australia, they've been trying to put, and they have been successful for the most part, putting pictures of diseased lungs on cigarettes. So when you go to buy a pack of cigarettes in Australia, you buy the cigarettes and there's a picture of a diseased lung on it. And that's what this climate change science back in the late 70s, early 80s was to the big oil and gas industry. It was the diseased lung on the picture of a pack of cigarettes. So,
do you think then, Joe, that industrialization, especially the oil and gas industries, will be the death of us before the spread of Fukushima is the death of us?
I have to tell you, a year ago or 2 years ago, I would have been very bleak, but I'm actually a little bit hopeful. One thing that I've noticed, that I'm actually working on a piece right now called The Mother of All Market Corrections that'll go up in about a week. And one of the things that I'm finding is that really oil and gas is a terrible misallocation of resources. Had that money that had gone into oil and gas and all of the infrastructure, the weaponry, the deployment of soldiers, the battles in the Middle East, why does the United States have to have the Fifth Fleet in Bahrain? Not because Americans really, really want the Bahrainis to have a nice lifestyle. It's because oil and gas is there. And had those resources been allocated somewhere else, like, say, solar early on, we already would have been out of this. But I could tell you right now, per megawatt hour, solar is now competing with coal. It is now competing with oil and gas. And interestingly enough, because the Saudis are flooding the market with oil and gas to try and crush their competition, even with that, driving the price of oil and gas down artificially, solar and renewables are competitive. I think it's actually we're in the last gasp of oil and gas. I think it's possible that the change can happen. We just don't know if it can happen soon enough.
Do you think, though, that change will come about peaceably?
Well, it's not coming about peaceably. I think I have a kind of a little new theory. I'd love to get your thoughts on it. I kind of think that the invasion of Iraq was the beginning of World War III. I think for all intents and purposes, when the United States has special operations forces in some way, shape, or form in 147 countries, we now have active military cooperation or operations in Malaysia. We've had them in the Philippines. We have them in Mali. We've had them in Libya. We have them in Syria. We have them in Iraq. You have what's happening on in Yemen, where the United States is providing air-to-surface munitions, including cluster bombs, which most other nations in the world have banned. The United States is providing them to Yemen, and Yemen is being destroyed. You basically have kind of war all over the place, and so much of it is related to oil and gas production. I would say that this may be the oil and gas war that's going on right now around the globe.
You're probably absolutely right about that. And when you talk about the fact that we have, as what Gore Vidal, George Orwell predicted, would be a perpetual war state, it seems to me that the United States has only won one war, the Second World War, which they would have never won without the Soviet Union. If the Soviet Union hadn't been so cold in the winter in Leningrad and froze all of those German troops, we would have never beaten them. Hitler would have gone into England, and that would have been the end of it. But we've lost every war since. We didn't win in Korea. It was a stalemate. We lost in Vietnam. We lost everywhere, absolutely everywhere. And it's because the American people really have no thirst for war whatsoever, but their government has been, you know, their government has taken all of this out of their hands. And it's like I've said a million times, I mean, voting in America is like voting your one stock of General Motors. You have no say over how they design the car. You just vote. Well, we have no say over how this war machinery is designed and with whom we invade next. So I'm not as optimistic as you are, but I am so glad to hear from somebody who is optimistic.
Well, John, don't accuse me of being an optimist here. You know, that's practically like being a communist in today's America.
The Barry Goldwater would be exorcised out of the Republican Party for being a damn socialist and radical for his very humane views of society, for crying out loud. Oh, my God.
It is a stunning development to see what has happened in American politics. And ultimately, you know, I've written about Marco Rubio. I think we still have to be worried about Marco Rubio, because if he were to become the alternative to Trump and get the nomination – that guy, if he was ever elected, I'm telling you, folks, it's fast track to war with Iran. That's the whole point of his campaign. And also belligerency versus Russia, which is also frightening. And Hillary Clinton, let's be honest, whatever happens, if Hillary Clinton wins, who wins? Wall Street and the military-industrial complex. And then America gets to pat itself on the back and say, see, we're progressive, we're evolving, we just elected a woman as president, and Wall Street's going to just back up the Brinks truck and have a field day.
Well, there you go, Joe. Thank you so much for destroying my optimism in about 30 seconds. Anyway, where can tell them where they can get News Vandal, and tell them where they can hear you next, please.
Yep. Okay, to get the rundown 5 days a week, every morning, sources from around the web and from different political perspectives. I aggregate, you decide. email me at info@newsvandal.com. That's NEWSVANDAL.com. Visit newsvandal.com to see stuff that I've written, and I will be on tomorrow, the Chuck Ocelli show, The Ocelli Effect. Just type in Ocelli Effect in Google, it'll come up, and I go on at 6 p.m. Pacific.
Well, Joe, thank you so very, very much. Thank you all for listening. And remember what I said at the top of the show, that the beauty you see is never as rewarding as the beauty you can create. You have a great night, folks. I'll talk to you again in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.